Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You've seen it in dime novels and Hollywood films. The Old West was a place for cowboys and outlaws, gambling in loud saloons, gunfights on dusty streets. Villains today, heroes tomorrow. A new novel imagines Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp before the gunfight at the OK Corral. It portrays John Henry Holliday as a young dentist and Dodge City card sharp, fading from tuberculosis long before his frontier legacy was sealed. This hour, On Point, the old Wild West reimagined. Later this hour, we'll turn to the New West and what's happening on the frontier now. You can join the conversation. What's your image of the Old West? Did you grow up watching Westerns and working on your lasso skills? Who are your Western heroes? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Cleveland, Ohio, is Mary Doria Russell. She's an award-winning novelist who's written deeply researched books on science fiction, historical fiction, and now Western fiction. Her latest novel is Doc. Mary Doria Russell, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
And congratulations on a beautifully crafted book. It was remarkable to me the way you rendered the Old West in a way that I hadn't seen before. And I thought I'd give our viewers a taste of that at the outset by asking you to read just a few paragraphs at the beginning, very beginning of your book. Could you do that, please?
Sure. Okay, this is from the very first chapter. It's called Playing for Time. He began to die when he was 21. But tuberculosis is slow and sly and subtle. The disease took 15 years to hollow out his lungs so completely they could no longer keep him alive. In all that time, he was allowed a single season of something like happiness. When he arrived in Dodge City in 1878, Dr. John Henry Holliday was a frail 26-year-old dentist who wanted nothing grander than to practice his profession in a prosperous Kansas cowtown. Hope, cruelest of the evils that escaped Pandora's box, smiled on him gently all that summer. While he lived in Dodge, the quiet life he yearned for seemed to lie within his grasp. At 30, he would be famous for his part in the gunfight at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona. A year later, he would become infamous when he rode at Wyatt Earp's side to avenge the murder of Wyatt's younger brother, Morgan. To sell newspapers, journalists of his day embellished thin fact with fat rumor and rank fiction. It was they who invented the iconic frontier gambler and gunman, Doc Holliday. Thin, mustachioed, a cold and casual killer, doomed and always dressed in black as though for his own funeral. That unwanted notoriety added misery to John Henry's final months, when illness and exile had made of him a lonely and destitute alcoholic, dying by awful illness, by awful inches and living off charity in a Colorado hotel. The wonder is how long and how well he fought his destiny. He was meant to die at birth. The fates pursued him from the day he first drew breath, howling for his delayed demise.
Wow. Thank you.
That's the first page.
Well, and it gets better from there. And I've got to tell you, the thing that struck me about the book was, as compared to the celluloid version, this is somebody who did have a moral sense and a moral code. I was struck by an exchange that you have in the book between Doc Holliday and his wife or girlfriend, whatever.
His companion.
Not sure what her status actually was. But she was talking about the people that he was dealing cards to and urging him to sort of fleece them. And he said he felt bad about it.
It made him feel like a thief. John Henry Holliday was a beautifully educated man of the 19th century. He was familiar with Homer and Virgil and Flaubert and their original languages. He was a classical pianist. And he goes out to a place where he's playing cards against people who are not, shall we say, overburdened by education. He can count. He knows how many nines there are in a deck. And so he knows when it's time to stop hoping that that straight is going to fill. And so it just makes him feel awful. They break his heart, the people who come to play against him. On the other hand, he's too sick to practice dentistry, except for just this one year that I write about. And there's no welfare. There's no unemployment. It's you have to work and make a living or starve or beg. And so he plays cards.
And so many of the women in the novel are prostitutes, including his companion, Kate, who's just as literate as he is.
Yes. Again, here's another person who was born for a different life. Her father, Kate Haroni's father, was Dr. Michael Haroni. He was the physician who practiced at the court of Maximilian I of Mexico. And so she was well-educated, grew up surrounded by refinement and sophisticated art. And the Emperor Maximiliano was overthrown in a revolution in the 1860s. And suddenly her family was tipped off. Apparently Dr. Haroni had made friends among the people who worked for him. And someone came to them and said, "You've got to get out of town, and now." And they left before the executions began. And so they ended up going from Mexico City and the court of Maximilian I to Davenport, Iowa, where there was another group of Hungarian immigrants. And Dr. Haroni believed that they would receive a welcome there. And they did for a while. But both of her parents sickened and died. And then the family was broken up, and she was fostered out. And Kate became, instead of having servants, she became a servant. This is all in the space of 6 months when she's 14. And then during the night, the foster father ruined her. And so she ran away from home pregnant with just a few words of English, and she made her own way, beholden to no one. And she died at 90, still feisty. Wow. And in charge of her life.
Mary, I want to ask you in a moment what got you on this topic and how you did your research. And I want to tee that up by playing a little audio clip from a movie and ask you if this was part of your research. Let's hear it.
Where are noisy? Where are?
Let's quit. I want to get out of here.
You just keep dealing. I'm not breaking this run. Hit me.
Doc, please.
Deal.
That was Kirk Douglas in the 1957 film Gunfight at the OK Corral. Corral.
It's about the only thing that's accurate in most of the movies are the names. They're really pretty terrible.
So tell me how you went about separating mythology from reality in your research.
Well, I always start with biographies. And the one that was most important to the way I portrayed Doc, and I think which is the most accurate, is by Karen Holliday Tanner. It's called Doc Holliday, A Family Memoir. And Ms. Tanner is a descendant of Doc's family. He had no children, so there are no direct descendants. But she had access to family records and family documents and memoirs that had never been made public before. And so in 2001, when she published her biography, it just gave an entirely different outlook on this man. It allowed me to write about Alice Holliday's son, to take him literally from the day he was born and bring him forward to the day he died when he was 36. In most portrayals of Doc Holliday, he shows up fully formed at the age of 30 on the streets at Tombstone, you know, with a bad reputation and a hooker named Big Nose Kate. And that's where people start. It just doesn't. It doesn't do the man justice, and I don't think it's as good a way to tell the story.
Well, how did you?
I peeled away all of the stuff that was written before that.
So, how did you approach the choice of whether to write a novel or simply to write a more accurate biography than had been done before?
Well, you know, the thing about novels is that they can bring heart into the story. I work with a lot of historians' work, and a lot of I go deep on all of the characters. I try to know what their parents were like. I want to know what the history, what political issues and wars were being fought when they were kids. I think that everybody pretty much either builds on their childhood or they react against their childhood. So those first 14 years are really important to understand. So I'll go out and see, you know, what else is happening in the rest of the culture while these people are growing up. And I do think that when people write about the Old West, they have this tendency to think of the cattle drives and the pioneers and isolated boom towns as though they were on another planet. But this is the same era, the 1870s, and an amazing moment of fluorescence of culture and technology and science around the world. And when you know John Henry's childhood, you know that that's the world that he was born and bred for.
Well, you mentioned science. One of the things that's interesting to me is what exactly was the state of dentistry in the late 19th century?
It was miles ahead of medical training. I used to teach anatomy, gross anatomy, at Case Western Reserve University.
Good preparation
School
for this
of
book.
Dentistry, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had two things going for me about writing about these men. For one thing, I had taught at a dental school. I was familiar with modern dental education, and so I was in a position to really be impressed by what John Henry Holliday mastered before he was 20.
I'm a long way from home. Lord, them people that don't like me better leave me alone.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the Old West. Doc Holliday, Wyatt Earp, and the high days of gunslinging saloon brawls. Actor Val Kilmer played Doc Holliday in the 1993 Tombstone. Here's a clip from that film where Doc Holliday spooks his nemesis, Johnny Ringo.
Why, Johnny Ringo, you look like somebody just walked over your grave.
Fight's not with you, Holliday.
I beg to differ, sir. We started a game we never got to finish. Play for blood, remember?
I was just fooling about.
I wasn't.
Mary Doria Russell is still with us. She's the author of the novel Doc. And joining us now from Colorado Springs, Colorado, is Mark Lee Gardner. He's an historian, writer, and musician of the Old West experience. His most recent book is To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West. Mark Lee Gardner, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me, John.
Mark, let me ask you, in light of Mary's book, which was spellbinding for me, what do we still have yet to learn about the Old West, or are we just getting one richer picture after the other? Is there new knowledge still coming out?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, all the time, even after 130, 150 years, sources come to the surface, diaries, journals. You know, modern technology has really enhanced the efforts of historians simply through contemporary newspapers. Online now, there's literally thousands of pages of contemporary newspapers that have been scanned and are searchable online, and that before, historians might spend years going through microfilm to find a reference to Doc Holliday or Wyatt Earp, and now they're at your fingertips, literally.
Yeah. Now, to what degree let me just ask one more, and then Mary, I'm going to ask you to do a reading. But Mark, to what degree are the modern films, like Val Kilmer in Tombstone, presenting a more accurate portrait as opposed to the Kirk Douglas film that Mary referred to and said the only thing accurate was the names?
Well, I don't know that they're really more accurate. The way I look at it, I don't get real uptight about these portrayals in film. But to me, Doc Holliday, Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, they exist in a different world in cinema, and often I enjoy how we reinterpret those larger-than-life characters for each generation and those portrayals. And I think it goes with Mary's novel. Here's another reinterpretation, and what can we learn from that?
Mary, I want to ask you to read the second reading that we selected. It's your description of Front Street in Dodge City, which for me, in words, brought to life more vividly than any pictures I've seen in a movie of what that world might have been like.
Thanks. Front Street was alive with young men, sauntering, staggering, laughing, puking, shouting in fierce strife or striking lewd, whispered bargains with girls in bright dresses. They were giddy with liberty, these boys, free to do anything they could think of and pay for, unwatched by stern elders, unseen by sweethearts back home, unjudged by God, who had surely forsaken this small, bright hellhole in the immense, inhuman darkness that was West Kansas.
Mary, I have to ask you one thing that arises from that incredibly vivid description. I recognize that Dodge City was about cattle drives and, as you said, extracting money from Texas. But where were the women, girls, who were not prostitutes?
There were farm wives. There were a few women in that town during the era that I'm writing about who were lawfully married. But the problem was that if your husband died, you were maybe 800 miles away from any family that you might have left to go there. And there were not a lot of alternatives to prostitution. There were dressmakers, but how many women were there who could buy dresses from you? There was no school yet in Dodge City, so if you were educated, you might have been a school marm, but there weren't that many children in this town. And so there just wasn't a lot that women could do. They were totally dependent on the male that they had hooked up with. And even if they were married, that didn't necessarily guarantee a thing.
Mark Lee Gardner, let me ask you about race relations in the Old West. One of the fascinating things in Mary's book is the story of the death of Johnny Sanders, who is I guess he was mixed race, but considered black by people in Dodge City, and the quest to figure out what happened to him. We know about race relations in the American South, where John Henry Holliday was from, but what about in the Old West?
Well, it was just as bad in the Old West as it was in the South and in the North. There were lynchings in the West, but also if you look at the relationship with American Indians in the West, which makes the West, you know, more unique from the rest of the country, there were just as drastic, you know, discriminatory and racist attitudes towards American Indians here also. So, I mean, it was definitely a very heated environment and intense feelings on all sides of that issue.
But, Mary, given that fact, which Mark just said, how do you account for that remarkable scene where Doc Holliday takes such offense at the suggestion that he might have been sort of talking down to and about Johnny Sanders that he forced somebody with some menace to apologize for that implication?
Well, he was really insulted by what that man said about – was implying about Doc himself.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean, that he was a racist. But in fact, if race was such a clear and present dividing line in the South where he came from and in the Old West, why would that be so insulting to him?
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things – and you would have to ask someone who has to deal with this today to find out if it's still true. But years ago, it used to be said that in the South, a black person could become close to a white person but not above him. In the North, you could become an equal, but you couldn't become close. And so Doc is coming out of this era in the Civil War that is kind of reflected in Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. She was a cousin of Doc Holliday's. And many of the stories that she tells are also his family stories. And there was a closeness between blacks and whites that is hard for Northerners or even modern people to understand. I also think that Doc took offense because he doesn't like being categorized himself. He wants to be taken for who he is personally and not as the representative of all Southerners. And that was partly why he went off on Alexander von Angensberg.
All right, let's go to one of our listeners who's on the phone from Worcester, Massachusetts. Ron, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Thank you. I was just curious. You've mentioned several Hollywood versions of the Earp and Holiday relationship, or specifically the OK Corral gunfight. Has anyone discussed Wyatt Earp's own so-called reminiscences that I believe were published in the 1920s or early 30s?
Yeah,
which,
that would be Stuart
Lakes. Which, as I understand it, I mean, more fiction than fact.
Mary?
Yeah, Stuart Lake is the author of that biography, and it was published after Wyatt died. Wyatt lived into his 80s. He died, I believe, in 1929, and the book was published about 18 months later. At the time, we're coming out of an era where tall tales or lying outright was an art form, and everybody got rich off of the OK Corral except for Wyatt, and he was very bitter about that. On the other hand, I think that he told Stuart Lake the truth as he saw it, although he might have stretched things some. And after Wyatt died, I believe that Stuart Lake on his own decided to take a lot of what Wyatt's older brother Virgil did and ascribe it to Wyatt. Virgil was a lifelong lawman and died with a star on. Wyatt never really wanted to be a lawman. He kind of stumbled into it, and he fell back on it when he had to. But that made Wyatt Earp sound like he was taking credit for things that he never did. I believe he probably said that his brother did that, and Stuart Lake simply simplified the story and focused on a single, easily understood, heroic tale.
Mark, I want to go to another caller, Sharon from Sherborne, Massachusetts. And Sharon, I think you've got a question about the differences between Canada and the United States. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, it's Karen. Doesn't matter.
Sorry.
Thanks for my call. My question, I'm a Canadian living in the U.S., and my question, based on some history that I know about the Western Canadian and how it was settled, and there was gold up there as well, is that the Northwestern Mounted Police were there as it was being settled. So there was a very different law presence. And I'm just curious, because there was obviously many factors that had the western part of both our countries settled very differently. But if either of your guests have any sense of sort of the timing of when law enforcement came in and how it was different in Canada and how that created the environment that led to sort of this lawlessness environment as opposed to in Canada. I know from reading a little bit that one of the Indian chiefs actually fled from the U.S. up to Canada and was given sanctuary there, and then when he came back down was killed in the U.S.
It's a really interesting question, Karen. Mark, what do you say?
Well, it is true that she's talking about Sitting Bull after the debacle on Little Bighorn for George Armstrong Custer and the intense efforts of the United States to quash the Indians that were off the reservation, so to speak. And yes, Sitting Bull flees to Canada, and the treatment of American Indians in Canada is certainly different than what's happening in the United States. As far as the law enforcement, I don't know that I could actually be the best person to talk about that. I can say that, you know, Canada also had boom mining towns and dealt with some of the same issues as we dealt in the United States in the late 19th century. But I'm not really as familiar with Canadian Old West history as I am with American West history.
I would just add that there's probably the same cultural differences between Canada and the United States back then as there are today. It's just a very different kind of approach to life.
All right. I want to go to contemporary Hollywood and get you to react to this. One of the summer's anticipated blockbusters is Cowboys and Aliens, set in Absolution, Arizona in 1873 in the midst of an alien invasion. I'm not sure whether that's a novel or whether it's something that's been discovered. But here Harrison Ford decides what to do when a wounded alien escapes from town after a raid.
I don't know what it is, but it's bleeding. It's the same direction those machines went with our kin. Ain't gonna be able to track it in the dark.
Round up the horses, get some supplies. We'll set off first light.
All right, Mary, I know that's a little out of left field, but
it certainly is.
but as the author of a book on the Old West that's out this summer, you've got to like it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of interest in the West again. I think probably Deadwood has a lot to do with that. I think that the reinterpretation of the West is something that's happening again. My own reaction, well, I can't speak to the movie that you just quoted because I haven't seen it and I'm not real familiar with it. But I think that we're possibly moving, at least in fiction, towards understanding individuals rather than writing about the good guys and the bad guys and categorical people. And maybe that's why there is more interest in the West today. We're going to try and reinterpret it in the early 21st century. Maybe we're getting enough of a distance on what happened during those years to be able to come at it from a completely different perspective. But I have to say, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. There's a lot of people who see unexplained lights in the Southwest, so I suppose
exactly. It
makes sense to do this.
Well, let's set cowboys and aliens aside, though I will say I'm confident that Harrison Ford will sell you a few books. But Mark, on the point that Mary made about the sort of binary choice between good and evil, is the fundamental untruth or myth that we have incorporated into the American psyche about the Old West, is that there was a fundamental divide? Is it, in fact, a lot grayer than that?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, John. What you're asking about—
Are the black hats and the white hats as distinct as we have imagined in popular fiction?
You know, actually, no. In fact, sometimes we call them gray hats. You know,
that's
people
my
like,
point.
Yeah, you know, White Earp was often just as much on the other side of the law as he was on the right side of the law. And in fact, your famous lawmen often came from the elements that they were trying to suppress or keep in check because they knew how to fight those guys. I mean, you know, if you have a guy that's been on the other side of the tracks and he knows how to handle a gun, and that's the guy you want to put those rowdy cowboys in jail and disarm them. And it's often really gray hats that we're looking at, and it's not usually so distinct who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Some lawmen were hired guns, just like the guys they were going after.
Well, and of course, we see those as the antecedents to some in modern law enforcement, because informants that many police officers use are also bad guys, and they're helping the good guys.
Exactly.
Mary, how is the book doing so far? And I know the reviews that I've seen have been extremely favorable.
They have been lavish. They really have. I've really sincerely thought about having one of them tattooed on my arm. It was so good. Yes, it's the book is a national bestseller, and the response to it has been really spectacular. And I'm getting so many. I get email from guys, you know.
And you've got a sequel in the works.
Yeah, yeah. I got to take the boys to Tombstone. You know, I gave them this summer in 1878 when they first met and when the relationships were formed. And I really do think that might have been Doc's best year as an adult. I need to take them 3 years ahead and see what's happened to them and try to understand how the men that I know from all of this research and from spending 3 years in their company, how they got to the point where, you know, a guy like Doc Holliday could look at somebody 6 feet away and pull the trigger on a shotgun.
Mary Doria
Russell,
that's
a different man.
Congratulations on your achievement. She's the author of Doc. Mark Lee Gardner will go out with one of your songs, Rex Ride Out to Santa Fe Trail. And when we return, we'll turn to the New West on the frontier of land use, energy, and more. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Oh, I know a gal down on the border that I'd ride to El Paso to sight. I'm acquaint with the high step in order, and I've sometimes kissed some gal goodnight. But Lord, they're all fluffles and beaten, or afternoon tea by the pail, compared to the kind of stampeding that I got on the Santa Fe Trail.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about the West, a new frontier for energy, agriculture, politics, and more. Mark Lee Gardner's with us. He's an historian and musician of the Old West. And joining us now from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, is William Deverell. He's an historian at the University of Southern California, director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. Bill Deverell, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. I'm happy to be here.
Bill, let me ask you this. I was out vacationing with my brother in central Colorado a few weeks ago. We drove through, at one point, the town of Leadville, which is a place that Doc Holliday spent at least a brief part of his life. Tell me what's different about Leadville, Colorado, and the American West today that strikes you the most?
Well, I'd preface my remarks by saying there's a lot of continuities between Old and New West that we may want to drift into. But in terms of difference, great chunks of the Intermountain West now are absolute leisure and recreational playgrounds for thousands upon thousands of people in the winters and the summers. And the West is turning its eye and its economy to a lot of those people, catering to outdoor sports enthusiasts. And that, while that's not brand new, it certainly has become extremely important in Western politics, culture, and economy.
So what are the implications of that if the Western economy turns from mineral extraction and agriculture to tourism? Does that mean you've got a class of environmentally oriented Easterners coming out who all of a sudden, is that why the Democrats held their convention in Denver a few years ago, and it's why Colorado's elected Democratic governors the last couple of times?
Well, certainly part of the equation. Where we used to think we could fairly closely identify, let's say, red and blue political identifications in the West, it's become a lot more complicated now. There are people that are talking about the new purple West, where red and blue collide into one another. And at heart of it, there is a fair amount of very new and environmentally quite interesting consciousness or political loyalties and allegiances that the Democratic Party, for instance, probably did make a deliberate effort to cater to.
So, Mark, does that mean the exemplar of the modern-day West is not Billy the Kid, but college kids on snowboards out in out in Colorado and Idaho and other places out in the West?
Well, possibly. I see it still, if that's the case, it's still kind of this boom-bust cycle that's been the whole story of the West. You know, whether it's tourism, you know, is that going to last, or how long is that going to last? Is it going to be energy, or is it going to be computer chips? You know, we've been going through this, since those boom towns like Leadville.
Well, that's very interesting. You mentioned the energy equation. We've seen the West making some moves toward what Democrats would consider a more progressive energy policy, things like requiring utilities to use more renewable energy. On the other hand, you've got new technology for extracting natural gas and oil shale deposits, which raise a fresh set of environmental questions at a time when the country is turning toward what do we do about our energy policy?
Well, I can jump in there a little bit. You know, the West has a lot of sun. The West has, in certain parts, a lot of wind, and those are attractive for new energy ventures. At the same time, the West has, as Mark knows, the West has a ton of oil shale, and the West has a ton of coal. And so even while some of these new ventures are gaining traction and venture capital and friendly legislation and subvention, some of the older industries are getting technologically very, very sophisticated. And so they're both going on at the same time, and oftentimes, either politically, culturally, or otherwise, they collide with one another.
And who's got the upper hand?
Well, that's a good question. You know, one of the continuities between Old and New West is the presence of gigantic corporate authority and corporate capital and corporate power. And so we have plenty of that in the American West, and those are institutions that are not to be trifled with politically. So it can be a struggle.
And what are the implications, Mark, for the fact that there is so much federally owned land in the West, and you've had a traditional push and pull between the desire for the government to extract more money from people who are using that land, and the desire to keep taxes down and keep expenses down for the people who are using it.
Well, I think that's a really good point, and it goes way back in the history of the American West, and that, you know, we've always had this close relationship or dependency on the federal government. And, you know, whether it's the Homestead Act or military forts that are part of the economy of local communities. And, of course, Colorado Springs has Fort Carson. But that relationship has been there from the very beginning. And it is this pull, especially, as far as, accessing Forest Service lands for drilling oil or gas exploration. But you also have a large contingent that are very concerned about the environment and conservation and doing these things in a very cautious way. So it's something that's being debated as we speak.
And I'd say, too, as well, excuse me, John, but I'd say, the issue is not often exactly who owns the land, whether it's publicly owned or privately owned, but at what level is that land open for leasing or easements or other access for timber, mining, other extractive industries? So that push and pull about the leasing and the opening of the land is a constant in Western history.
Bill, I want to ask you about one thing related to the topic in our first hour, which was the implications for government finances of a potential default and the stalemate in Washington. A lot of domestic spending goes to things that ordinary Americans like from time to time, maybe not constantly, but I think of national parks out in the West. To what extent is that an issue in Western politics that leavens the more traditional sense that we've had of the West as a place that's very conservative fiscally?
I think it's a huge issue in the American West, in part because of the challenges the federal fiscal environment faces right now, so in terms of staffing and support and upkeep of federal installations and facilities, the military is one, the national parks are another, and then the trickle-down into state control of state parks or even local parks. So where I'm from in Southern California, we're seeing real challenges about the ability of local, state, and federal governing structures to keep those places open and active for the citizenry, and that's spread out entirely across the American West.
Mark, let me ask you, I was joking with you before about Billy the Kid and kids on snowboards, but in a more serious vein, the iconography of the West, we think of images like the Marlboro Man, and it's macho, it's ruggedly independent, all of the things that we associate with a more fiscally conservative and libertarian brand of politics. On the other hand, we know the Democrats have increasingly, because of the influx of people from the East and some refugees from California moving to Nevada and other places, have looked at the Intermountain West as a target. Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, among others, Montana. How do you think of the politics of the West and what direction are they headed?
Well, I think you bring up a really interesting idea, and that the West, like it was historically in the 19th century, is still a transient type of population. I mean, here in Colorado, people have the bumper stickers that say native, and, they're very proud of that because there's so few people that were actually born here. I mean, they usually came from someplace else, California or Texas, and just like Doc Holliday came from Georgia and Wyatt Earp came from Illinois. So there's that constant flux in politics, depending on, where they're from, what their background is. In Colorado Springs, it's the most conservative part of the state, and primarily because of Fort Carson. A lot of the military that served at Fort Carson retires here in Colorado Springs. That hasn't changed for decades. Just to the north of us in Denver, that's where, as you mentioned before, that's where the Democratic National Convention was, more liberal. We're about an hour apart. So I don't know exactly where it's going or if there's going to be great changes in the future. We do have this feeling of being a transient population that doesn't have a big stake or at least a long-term stake in being here.
All right, let's take a call. We've got Avi on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because if we're talking about the New West, I'm curious to know if the experts have anything to say about water. my understanding, based on personal experience, has always been that water is the most precious commodity in the West, but I don't hear much in the national media about how it's being allocated and whether people should be concerned. And I'd like to ask that question to the panel.
Bill Deverill, water wars have been raging for years in California and other places. What about the issue of water and its availability in the West?
It's a terrific question. There's a couple of things going on that people should be aware of. One are environmental changes and some periods of fairly severe drought. The Intermountain West has got one. We've got one in California and the Southwest. So the resources themselves are undergoing a lot of stress. And then on top of that, the ways in which water's moved around the West, how it's priced, who owns it, private, local, state, or federal authorities, that's a complete hodgepodge, really messy economically. And so until we get some real rationality in there, these water wars will continue, and then with environmental challenges, they're going to exacerbate.
All right, let's go to Heartland, Vermont. We've got Michael on the line. Michael, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
Thank you. Hi, John. Great discussion. I have read recently a couple of new works of scholarship about the West, particularly about Custer's Last Stand, and another book called Blood and Thunder about Kit Carson. And I'm not a particularly politically correct person, but I must say my perspective about what we Europeans did to the Native Americans and to some extent the Mexicans who were already there has affected my view of us. And I just wondered how big a factor this new effort to look at Native American perspectives in all this, what your panelists may think of that.
Mark?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I've done a lot of research with American Indian history and the military conflicts, and one of the things that I learned very early in talking with American Indians is that, you know, Anglos tend to look at the history of the past as something that happened a long time ago, but with American Indians, it happened yesterday to them. I mean, they live with that history. And we still see the consequences and the tragedy from, you know, what we call the Indian Wars, the reservations, Pine Ridge, you know, one of the poorest places in the country today. I mean, this is a living reminder of that conflict and who lost in that. And they're still losing and suffering from that conflict. So it's not really history. It's something that we're still dealing with, and we really haven't done very well by it.
And Bill Deverill, if it's not history, to what extent is that on the political agenda of Western states and communities right now?
Well, in some respects, the key issue in that regard, in terms of the West, the old West embrace of conquest, so let's say the Mexican-American War in the middle of the 19th century, the consequence and ramification of that in the latter day, in the 21st century, will be a question mark, for instance, for the Republican Party. Can the Republican Party in the American West make some real inroads and claims upon Mexican-American and other Latino migrants or immigrants to this part of the American West? And so those questions and issues are still going to be incredibly salient as we move forward into the 21st century a little bit further.
Interesting biographical point about one of the congressional guests in our first hour, Tom Cole of Oklahoma, is the only Native American now serving in Congress. Let's now go to Dana from Brewster, Massachusetts. Dana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. You know, it's always been of interest to me that despite the usual Western narrative or rhetoric of rugged individualism, independent thinking, no big government into our lives, that a lot of, and that whole bootstrap nonsense, that a lot of ranchers graze their cattle on federal land for bargain basement prices. And not only that, they also want to see the endangered grizzly bear exterminated and the mountain lion. I mean, I would just like your guest to speak to that, please.
So, Mark, what about it? Welfare for the West?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it welfare. I mean, I think it goes back to the point I made earlier, and that there's always been this relationship with the federal government. I mean, the West has kind of survived with the help from the government in Washington, D.C., and often those two groups come into conflict, and your caller brings up a good point, you know, huge fights over the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone and the wolf in New Mexico. You know, these come into conflict with the ranching interests because they, you know, they spent decades trying to exterminate the predators so that their cattle would not be killed or consumed and they could get them to market. So while the West needs the help of the government, they only want a certain amount and they would like to be left alone to their, you know, American individualism at other times. And we're still dealing with that issue.
Bill Devereaux, is the role of government in the West in the 21st century growing or shrinking?
Well, some of that depends on the fiscal health of the government. So it may be shrinking in terms of the ability to bring dollars and employees into the American West. But the role of the government in the American West is incredibly powerful. And Mark's right and the caller's right to point out that irony that partly the West says to the federal government, go away, but don't leave us alone. So the government's going to be continue to be very, very powerful in Western economies, in Western culture, Western land use, firefighting, etc. But if it cannot bring the resources to bear, we're going to see some real challenges environmentally or otherwise as the federal government of necessity pulls back.
Fascinating hour. Bill Devereaux is an historian, director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mark Lee Garden's an historian and musician. His book is To Hell on a Fast Horse, Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett, and the Epic Chase to Justice in the Old West. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, John. Consider, thanks, Bill.
You can consider the continue the conversation to get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Gonna wash my soul, gonna get it clean, headed down the border road, call the El Camino.